The objective reality of God, Hebrews 11:6, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 26, 2004, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
Today, I would like to talk about the objective reality of God a little bit. It occurred to me that this is important. This won't be new, I don't think, but I think it's just something that we could be reminded of. In the Christmas season that we're just coming out of, all of the things that happen in our culture, all of the objections to Christmas song and the colors red and green and all the nonsense that happened in our culture just sort of reminded me of something that was first introduced into my thinking by Oz Guinness back 25 years ago in some books that he read, where he talked about the privatization of religion. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that phenomenon, what that is, the effect that it can have on us, and the implications, and then how we need to be aware of that and cautioned against it, I think. I want to use as a jumping off point the phrase in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, that famous verse where he says, "Now he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him." In that context, Paul, I think, in Hebrews 11, is talking about how it is that we gain eternal life. That is, who is it that is going to be blessed by God in the end? Who is a child of God? Who's going to be rewarded in the end by God? And he's defining what it is that characterizes the people that are going to receive eternal life. And the most minimal requirement is the one that he lists in chapter 11, verse 6, he who comes to God, and by comes to God in that context, he's implying there that they will receive eternal life and a blessing. Now, he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. So what characterizes the child of God is what they believe, ultimately. And what do they believe? Well, they must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. I want to emphasize the part, must believe that he is. I'm going to look at that this morning. What is it that we're believing when we believe that God is? What's happened over the course of history and has become so commonplace in our culture today that it's almost invisible to us, I think, is that a whole different kind of belief, concept of belief, has been introduced into our consciousness, such that there are people today who consider belief, religious belief, to be a different sort of belief than all the other beliefs that we have. I can believe that this podium is in front of me. I can believe that this microphone is in front of me. I can believe that you're out there listening. I can believe all those things, and that's one kind of belief. And that kind of belief is just having knowledge that the world is a certain way, and that's belief. But when it comes to religious belief, we don't mean that. At least so says so many voices in our culture. When it comes to religious belief, we're not talking about having a component of knowledge about the way reality is. We're talking about a story that we tell of ourselves that gives meaning and purpose to our lives somehow. That's what a religious belief is. And with that concept of belief, it doesn't have to be knowledge of reality. If reality doesn't match the story, oh well, aren't we cute anyway? I mean, it doesn't. The function of that kind of belief is not contingent on it matching and conforming to and corresponding to reality. Well, that's a very, very different concept of belief, and yet that, I think, has become the concept of belief that is beginning to prevail in our culture. Roger introduced me to Dennis Prager, and I've been listening to some Dennis Prager. I don't know if you've ever heard him. He's a Jew who has a talk show out of L.A. that plays around here in the mornings, in the weekday mornings. And I'm very impressed with him. And it's a very, of all the talk show hosts, I respect his attitude, his spirit, his way of interacting with people, his wisdom, his understanding. For the most part, it's really great. But just this past week, a woman, a Christian, called in and talking about Christian traditions and Christmas traditions and practices. And he made a comment that just really struck me, because this woman was Jewish by birth, but that fact had been hidden from her until well into her adulthood. So she had only later found out that she was Jewish. And she'd actually been raised by believing parents, so she was just raised as a Christian. And she was talking about appreciating both traditions now and how important that was. And I don't remember exactly what she said, but it elicited the response from Prager, "But if I believed that," namely something about Jesus, "if I believed that, then I would cease to be a Jew." A common line. Remember when Rabbi Lapin was here, that was his position, that if I believed in Jesus, I would no longer be a Jew. Now, aside from the fact that I think that's false, but aside from the fact that I think that's a false claim, he went on to say, I simply think that we need to believe and practice those things that will foster and nourish all of our traditions. I think he means Jews and Christians, because he's had some pretty critical things to say about Islam in the past. So he's not just for every religion, just because it's a religion. But we need to do that which will nourish and foster all of our traditions. Well, the thing that struck me is Dennis Prager is not a postmodern thinker. And what I mean by a postmodern thinker is a person who believes that what you believe just is reality to you, just is true to you, and there is no such thing as any belief or any story or any narrative that actually corresponds to the way it really is. There is no way it really is. There is only the way you see it. I mean, that's the popular view in the universities today that we call postmodernism. Well, Prager is not a postmodernist. He is very much a commonsensical, down-to-earth, rational thinker, nurtured in the Jewish tradition, in the scriptures, in the Bible. But when it came to this particular issue, it wasn't a question of, well, we need to sit down and have a long, hard conversation about which of our beliefs is true. It was, we need to foster and nourish both of our traditions. Now, not that I'm against that. I mean, Judaism is also true. I mean, I think there's that unique situation where both Judaism, rightly understood, and Christianity rightly understood, are not in conflict with each other. So there's a sense in which that could be true. But I believe what he meant, maybe I'm wrong, but I believe what he meant was, when all is said and done, my Jewish belief and your Christian belief are, after all, religious beliefs. They're not real beliefs, they're religious beliefs. And since they're religious beliefs, they play a different function. They are that which promote morality and goodness and good living and decency in our lives. They give meaning and purpose to our lives and so on. And as long as they are doing that and doing that successfully and effectively, then they are fulfilling their purpose, never mind whether they have anything to do with objective reality or not. Now, maybe I'm being unfair to him, but certainly if he didn't mean that, that's what the vast majority of people in our world today, in our culture today, mean when they talk about a religious belief. Well, what is Paul talking about when he says we must believe that he is? Is he saying we must tell ourselves the story about a God that we claim to be there, because that will give meaning and purpose to our life, and that will give us guidance, and that will give us strength, and that will, whatever that will do? Is that what Paul means? Or does he mean that we must come to know that it's true, that God is objectively real and that God exists, whether anyone believes it or not. I think that I'm convinced that everything in the Bible would suggest that what Paul means by that is the latter. The children of God, the people who come to know God, the people who are going to enter into eternal life, are the people who come to have as a part of their knowledge that it's true that God really is there, and he really has promised what he has promised, and he really is purposing what he is purposing, and whether anyone believes it or not, it's still going to be the case. It's still the way the world and the cosmos is going to go because God is there. That, I think, is what Paul means by he must believe that God is. So, if that's right, then we who are believers, we who are children of God, believe in the objective reality of God. And let me define my terms. By real, by saying that God is real, I mean that God has an existence that impinges on the way my life goes and the way the history of the world goes. It really affects it. It really governs it. It really changes it. It really alters it. God is the one in control. By objective, I mean God is real whether I know it or not, whether I acknowledge it or not, whether I care or not. But God's reality is a real reality, not a religious reality, a real reality. So I think the Bible teaches us the objective reality of God and insists that those who belong to God will come to believe the objective reality of God. They will come to embrace that. The problem is there's an important obstacle to us believing in the objective reality of God in our world today. It's a threat of what, let me just coin a term here, I will call the de-objectification of belief. And the de-objectification of our belief in God is due to a sociological force that Oz Guinness introduced to us through the sociologist Peter Berger before him, called privatization. So let me define and describe privatization for a second. In a society, we're leaving the individual level now, and let's talk about a whole society and a culture, because that culture puts forces on us that shape us and affect us. And privatization is something that happens at a cultural level within a society. In any given society, if an individual is permitted to have religious belief as a part of his personal beliefs and values, but that society does not give him permission to bring those beliefs into the public arena and make them in any way relevant to the course of public debate, public conversation, public discourse, then that phenomenon is called the privatization of religious belief. The point being, it's fine and dandy for you to have whatever religious beliefs you want to have as your private beliefs, your personal beliefs, your individual beliefs, but don't you dare make any sort of claim that what you believe as a religious belief can possibly be relevant to what we're doing as a government, as a society, in politics, and maybe not even in literature and art and so on. If somehow my beliefs are rendered irrelevant, either kindly and gently or hostily so, rejected, we have privatized religious beliefs in our culture. Well, this came to mind this Christmas season because we are seeing the evidence of privatized religious belief like crazy in the culture today. All the different ways in which the not just official government people, but private citizens complain and whine and object and treat with hostility any attempt to bring into public awareness and public consciousness the reality of Jesus or Christmas or his birth or Christian faith or whatever. There's this knee-jerk reaction against it. And what's the basis for it? It has no business go in public. That's all fine and good that you do your Christmas things in your own family the way you want to do it, but don't you dare bring it public, because that's some kind of terrible breach, some transgression. So privatization happens by coercion of one kind or another, shaming us, chiding us, rebuking us, warning us, threatening us, suing us. Various coercive methods are used to make sure that we keep our belief private and don't dare presume to go public with it. So you have the business policies refusing or prohibiting their employees from saying Merry Christmas during business hours, schools without nativity scenes. I read the one where they banned green and red for decoration for their winter holiday party. We've got slogans, propaganda slogans. The separation of church and state is has become a sacred principle for some people, even though it's virtually meaningless. I mean, in the end, how is it even possible to separate church and state? But it's become a sacred principle for a lot of people. The slogan, everyone has a right to his or her own religion. The truth is, nobody has a right to any religion. It's got to be true. If we're going to act like human beings ought to act, we ought to be seeking the truth, not religion. So, and yet, that we would find that widely accepted. And we ourselves, my point is, this privatization of religious belief becomes so powerful and so compelling and so effective that you and I begin to respond positively to slogans like this. We begin to internalize this and begin to think, that makes sense. That's the way it is. We need to keep church and state separate, and everyone has a right to his or her own religion. All the media commentary that we've seen in the past year, and especially in Christmas season, about not imposing our religion on this world, on this society. Christians being made the moral and religious equivalent of Osama bin Laden and the jihadist and the radical Islamic fundamentalists and so on, because we're both religious and we both think we're right. Well, not exactly deep intellectual analysis, but nonetheless, it resonates in our culture. Just on an aside about that, because the root cause of privatization is a kind of coercion, then if and when we decide to resist our culture's attempt to coerce the privatization of my religious belief, it's not first and fundamentally for the purpose of changing or influencing our culture, I don't believe. It's first and fundamentally for the purpose of countering the detrimental effects of privatization on my own beliefs, on my own soul. So if someone comes along and says, don't resist, don't react, don't do anything, don't respond, you're not going to change the culture. It's just too big, it's too huge, there's too much momentum, there's no way you can have an impact. I think they're right about that. We're not going to have an impact. The tide is too strong, and I think that's really true. But when I resist, I'm not resisting because I want to change my culture. I'm not resisting because I think I'm going to make a difference. First and foremost, I'm resisting for my own sake. I need to refuse to internalize this nonsense that is being shoved down my throat. It makes no sense what our culture is claiming. And I need to, for my own sake, object to it by acknowledging this makes no sense. No, I'm not going to shut up, because that would be silly. That would be ridiculous. This is objectively real. This is objectively true. And I'm going to tell you so. If we react in that way, it's not a good argument to say, it's not going to have any, not going to make a difference. That's true. It's not going to make any difference to my culture, but it may very well make a difference in my own being, in my own soul, in my own process. So what happens when we encounter a society and a culture that is putting on us all this pressure to privatize our religious beliefs? What happens? Well, at worst, it becomes a part of my own individual belief system. I internalize it in such a way that I myself believe, I myself am sort of psychologically, emotionally convinced, if you will, that my beliefs about God and the faith and Christianity are not relevant to the social and political issues being debated in the public arena today. I'm convinced. I have so internalized that perspective that my beliefs are only privately relevant, that I, without even thinking about it, have decided that religious beliefs are a different breed of cat than your ordinary everyday beliefs. And I myself have made the transition to thinking about my beliefs differently. Or if I don't go all the way to seeing them as believing that they're not relevant, at least it becomes a part of my own belief system that I cannot, that my beliefs cannot legitimately and validly be introduced into the debate, into the public arena. I may believe that they're relevant, but I don't believe I have any right to introduce them into the public and bring them up to public awareness. It's not merely that we're silenced by the culture and not permitted to say certain things. Certainly that's true. But it's not just that. Rather, it's that we have internalized the very premise that makes our society tell us to shut up. We have so internalized that we're telling ourselves to shut up. Be quiet. Don't speak. Don't think that way, because it's not either it's not relevant or you can't legitimately and validly introduce that into the equation. So let me look at one example in particular and try to analyze how we as Christians might respond to this. Take the fairly recent example of the attempt to force a change in American culture to see gay marriage as a valid institution, that a homosexual relationship and a marriage relationship could be combined into a valid and authentic marriage. Now, I'm assuming a fact here. Maybe not all of you agree with this, but I believe it's the case that the Bible teaches that homosexuality, like so many other things we human beings do, like so many things that you and I do, is a perversion of God's created purposes and God's order. So I'm taking that as a fact here. The question is that fact, assuming I'm right that it's a fact, is that fact in any way relevant to whether we in the United States will accept homosexual marriages as a valid institution? Well, there are several possible answers. The first possible answer is no, it's not relevant. I believe that homosexuality is wrong. I believe that homosexuality is a perversion of what God intended. But that's my belief. That's my religious belief. And I have no business bringing that belief into decision making when it comes to what our society and what our culture is going to do. I have no business doing that. Well, anyone who would answer in that way is someone who has completely internalized the privatization of religious belief and has come to accept that new definition of what belief is in a religious context that I talked about earlier. I don't think that's right, obviously. Second possible answer is the United States is not a Christian nation per se. The fact is, of course, relevant. The fact that homosexuality is a perversion is relevant, of course. And it's incumbent upon me to try to get as many people as I can to acknowledge that fact and to honor it. But given the sort of society that the United States is, it's not valid and reasonable for me to expect that its laws will and must prohibit all forms of evil and perversion. Okay, well, that answer acknowledges the objective reality of God up to a point, but only up to a point. Along with the reality of God, it has a distinctive view of what American society is and should be, namely that American society is and should be a religiously pluralistic society and should not strive to be otherwise. I don't think that's a valid belief, but it's a respectable belief. There are a lot of people I respect who hold that belief. I don't happen to agree with it. But it also goes on to place a value judgment. But it places a value judgment on the idea of the United States being a religiously pluralistic society that I believe is the effect of privatization. Namely, it's saying that it's good and valid that there should be different religious viewpoints. Well, from a common sense rational perspective, if Christianity is true, if God is objectively real, and Jesus really is objectively the Son of God, and he really has come into the world to accomplish what he said he was going to accomplish, and all that's true, then what's good about having religions who reject that? That makes those religions false religions, religions that have false beliefs. I don't even like Christianity that has false beliefs for the same reason, because we are created by God, and we should, in a pursuit of righteousness and goodness and integrity, we should be pursuing the truth, and we should be pursuing the true form of Christianity, the true expression and articulation of our Christian faith. It's not adequate to be a Christian. We must be believers of the truth. And if that's true within the context of Christianity, it's certainly true in our assessment of other religions. It's bad to be just a Jew. It's bad to be a Muslim. It's bad to be a Buddhist. It's bad to be a Hindu. And anything, any combination of those things. They're not rich traditions. They're lies and deceptions in the end. I mean, they may also be rich traditions aesthetically and culturally and all that. That may very well be true as well. But they are rooted in and founded on lies and deceptions. That's not a good thing, to have a society that, you know, takes a little bit of lies from all over the world and combines them. The best kind of society would be one where, in our search for truth, we are becoming closer and closer and closer together in our agreement on who God is and what he's done when he sent Jesus into the world. That's the best kind of society. And it seems to me that to deny that is to have already been affected by the process of privatization. We have already decided that religious belief is a different sort of belief that has nothing to do with whether or not it's objectively real. So I ultimately would reject that answer. A third possible answer is yes, the fact that homosexuality is a perversion is utterly relevant. A society that tolerates homosexuality and institutionalizes homosexual marriage is tolerating and institutionalizing perversion. And this is every bit as evil as a society that tolerates and institutionalizes economic injustice or slavery or greed or cruelty or any other perverse lust or attitude of mankind. And by the way, the fact that a whole generation of Americans, which I think is the case, has been inured to the perversion of homosexuality is no more an evidence that it is not perverse than the fact that a whole subculture within America at one time was inured to the perversion of slavery. That's irrelevant. We can be inured to all kinds of evil just because we are not outraged by it, just because we're not repulsed by it, just because we don't react against it, doesn't mean it's not perverse. This answer goes on to say, however, one cannot reasonably expect a society's laws and institutions to be reflective of values that are not embraced by the society as a whole. In other words, you cannot expect a society to be Christian if the people are not themselves Christian. So, while it is important to strive to persuade people and attempt to get moral laws and institutions, it is naive to think that one can impose values and institutions in America that are alien to the character of Americans, at least to do so without tyranny, which is itself an evil. For coerced righteousness is not authentic righteousness at all, and it is genuine righteousness that God is after. I think that answer fully acknowledges the objective reality of God and has a mature view of the nature of true righteousness and is not naive about the state of affairs in our country. The fourth answer is, yes, the fact that homosexuality is a perversion is relevant, and we should do whatever it takes, even to the point of tyranny, to keep pure and righteous laws and institutions in our society. And then we truly would become religious Taliban if we were to do that. And I think that would be wrong. That would be naive. That would be to not understand the teaching of the Bible itself about the nature of man, how man works, what righteousness is and what God is after, what he wants to accomplish, that would be horrible. But that is a fourth possible answer. So the third answer that I outlined, I think, is the answer that I would give, that I think is the right answer and the biblical answer, and one that does that takes into account the objective reality of God himself and his truth, and yet does so in a way that's not simplistic and naive and short-sighted. Okay, I've been speaking about the de-objectification of my belief in the context of social and political issues. What difference would it make in my personal life? Well, no, let me continue with a few more political social issues first. You know, what would it look like for me to believe in the objective reality of God? If God, and by that I mean the sovereign God of the Bible, not a God of my own invention, but the actual God of the Bible, if that God is objectively real, then what should I think, for example, about the fact that when I read through the Bible, I see God having actually deeded land in the world over to a nation, the people of Israel. He's deeded the land over them in perpetuity. And for all time, as long as there is a world that you can call a world, God has said that land belongs to you, the children of Abraham. Is that relevant to anything? Now, time out. There are people who maybe don't interpret the biblical text that way and don't believe that that is actually the case, that that's actually a biblical teaching. And that's a whole nother discussion and a whole nother debate that we may have sometime. But just grant me, for the sake of argument, that I have rightly understood the Bible in that regard, that God made a promise to Abraham and his children, and he intends to keep it. And the promise that he made is that I'm giving you this land, which is roughly the Near East today, the Middle East today. I've given you this land, and I'm making you my people. I'm going to be your God. You are going to be my people. I'm going to put you in the land, make you prosper in the land. You will be secure in the land from your enemies. I will protect you from your enemies. And we will get on with the experiment of you obeying me and serving me and me blessing you and protecting you. It's going to happen one day, according to biblical prophecy, as I would understand it. And in any case, he made this promise. What if I'm over in Israel talking to a Palestinian Christian, for example, who has had Israeli bulldozers come and bulldoze down his house and just kick him out and send him away and saying, tough, this land belongs to us, we're taking it, you get out of here, never mind that you're out of a house right now, too bad. How am I going to interact with them? On the one hand, I could look at and emphasize the injustice of what the Israelis have done. I could empathize and feel the pain of his injustice, of his being a victim of injustice, could identify it as injustice. I could do that. And I would do that because it would clearly be unjust. Just because God has given you the land doesn't give you the right to be cruel and unfeeling and greedy and selfish and all the other stuff that I think goes on in Israel today. But does it ever become relevant in any way in my conversation with this Palestinian Christian? Does it ever become relevant? But you do have to understand, God gave this land to the Jews. It seems to me, if God is objectively real, and his promises are objectively real promises, and his purposes are objectively real purposes, it seems to me that there's no other way to think about it than that that is highly relevant. And in my counsel, part of what I would have to help this Palestinian Christian come to terms with is, there's something bigger than you and me going on here. God is bringing his people back into his land to one day fulfill the promises that he's made to them. Those were objectively real promises, objectively valid. They have an objectively valid claim to the land. It was the Creator himself who authorized their ownership of this land. You can't get a higher authority than that. And given that he has done that, you and I have no choice but to acknowledge the legitimacy of their claim. We were poaching? Is that what you do? We were illegally residing on a land that didn't belong to us. And it's too bad that they had to be so lacking in compassion and so obnoxious about the way they reclaimed their land. But the fact of the matter is, the land is theirs. And I need to come to terms with that. And we both need to come to terms with that. It seems to me that at a cultural, political level, that's taking the objective reality of God and his purposes and his promises seriously. And anything short of that is to say, well, it's all fine and good that the Bible tells a story about God making a promise to Abraham and his people and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure that gives meaning to a lot of Jewish lives. And it might even give meaning to a lot of evangelical lives. But let's not like base policy on that. Well, I don't think we can have it both ways. Either it's real or it's not. And if it's not, then I don't think it gives meaning to anybody's lives. If it is real, then how can we not base policy on it? How can we not take it seriously as a part of the reality of what's going to go on in the world? Now, exactly what policy to base on it is a whole other question. But my point is, it's a relevant fact that cannot be rejected as irrelevant. Well, that was one example. We could look at a lot of different examples. But let me move now to what about the impact on my personal life as an individual. What if Abraham's belief in God had been de-objectified through privatization in the way that we see that in America today? That he believed in this God who had made promises to him, but they weren't objectively real. They were a different kind of belief from an ordinary belief. Would he have taken the step of migrating to a whole new unknown land, a whole new part of the world that he had not known? How could his experience with God, whatever that experience with God was, how could his experience with God be relevant to something as objective, important, and momentous as an uprooting of his whole life and family and going to another corner of the world? How could it be relevant to that? Unless the experience was bringing him into touch with an objectively real God. It wasn't just a meaningful religious experience. He had made contact with a God who really was there, who really was in control of history, who really was making promises, and so on. I don't think Abraham, with a privatized belief, would have acted on his experience, on his encounter with God. Would he have had himself and his household circumcised? No, I don't think so. Would he have gone so far as to be willing to kill his own son Isaac as an offering to God? It seems even if he had done the other two things, he would have drawn the line there. This is taking religion a little too far, don't you think? You're asking me to kill my only child, or my promised child? At that point, you claim the irrelevancy of your religious belief to your actions. The same, it seems to me, will be true for us. If God is objectively real, then his reality impinges on every aspect of our personal lives. If we're unmarried, or childless, or jobless, or in poverty, or unhappy and miserable and in pain, or if we look at my life and declare myself to be a loser and a failure, if those are the situations we're in, it seems to me that the objective reality of God and his promises and purposes is perfectly relevant to our situation. God is working out his purposes in our lives, and I can know that his purposes are ultimately good. I think I'll talk about that in a future week. They may not feel good, I may not experience them as goodness, but they are ultimately good. That's an objectively real fact, if what the Bible says is true. So if I'm childless or unmarried, it is because God knows something I don't know about the story of my life. If I'm a loser or failure by society's standards, it's because God is making my life the story of a very different kind of success. If I am unhappy, it is because it has not been given to me to find happiness in the particular story that God is authoring in my life right now. Instead of happiness, what he's giving me is authenticity and reality and contact with the way things really are and the God who really is. And in the end, that's what's important. The goal of my life is not, should not be, must not be happiness. The goal of my life must be authenticity, contact with reality, being in touch with what the God, the author of all things, is doing. And to be a part of that, to come to understand that, to come to terms with that, and by coming to terms with that story, to come to terms with the God who's the author of that story. Because it's my relationship with my Creator that is the ultimate meaning of my existence. It's not happiness that gives meaning. There's all kinds of happy people whose lives are utterly and completely empty and hollow. But there's nobody who's in touch with the author of their being who is empty and hollow, because that's the point of our existence. We have to remember that the objective reality of the biblical God puts him in an absolutely unique position. I think all too often we think that God should be a rational Santa Claus to us, a rational benefactor in our lives, one who gives us what is most likely to be in our best interest in my present circumstances and in view of how the future is most likely to go. So in other words, we expect God to sit up there, wherever he sits, to sit up there and look down on my life and make an estimation, a prediction about how my life is likely to go, and in light of how my life is likely to go, to give me what would be of most benefit to me in view of the fact of how my life is most likely to go. That's how we're looking at our lives, and we're judging God's gifts to us and God's providential control of my life based on what I would do if God knew what I knew about how my life is likely to go. We think God should be kind to us and bless us in the way that a rational and compassionate person would do, that is, a person who does not and cannot know the future. So we think God should act toward us as if he doesn't know and cannot know the future, but that's the problem. That's not God. The God who's objectively there does know the future. He knows every nanosecond of the future. So it doesn't always appear to us that God is providing for us in a manner that a prudent sovereign who is compassionate would provide for us. But the reason is because God does not need to be prudent. He doesn't need to rationally calculate the risks and probabilities. He's not seeking to do what is prudent with respect to an unknown future. Rather, he's ordering my life in keeping with the future that he knows with 100% certainty lies ahead for me. And obviously, he's going to make different choices than the prudent person would make. Belief in the objective reality of God, therefore, should provide an entirely new and different sort of basis from which to judge his providential oversight of my life. He is not somehow failing to be good and compassionate toward me if he doesn't do what I know would be prudent. It provides a new and different context from which to decide to trust him and to still the anxious stirrings in my soul when I recognize that there's an objectively real God who really does know the future and is in control of my every life. Okay, I'll break it off there because I want to leave plenty of time for you to interact, and you maybe can fill in some holes in my comments.
Could I ask you to go back and clarify something? You were talking about your four different approaches to mm-hmm. the question of homosexual marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to number two, and I was listening to number two, and I was thinking, yeah, but, and then you got to number three, and I said, oh, okay, yeah, that's the one, number
right.
three. But then I couldn't figure out what the difference was between number two and number three. I couldn't go okay. back and remember what I was having problems with. So could you talk about your number two and number three options and what the difference was between them?
Let's see. Two was, let me read it. The U.S. is not a Christian nation per se. The fact that homosexuality is perverse is, of course, relevant, and it is incumbent upon me to try to get as many people as I can to acknowledge this fact and honor it. but given the sort of society that the U.S. is, it is not valid and reasonable for me to expect that its laws will and must prohibit all forms of evil and perversion. What I went on to talk about is a religiously pluralistic society and how that's a good and right sort of thing, actually a valuable sort of thing, and it's the kind of society that we should be. So I may not have expressed it very well in the way I wrote it, but what I have in mind there is the sort of society that the U.S. is a religiously pluralistic society. It ought to be a religiously pluralistic society, and therefore we have no business building into our institutions something that is compatible with some religions and not others, some religious beliefs and other religious beliefs. Whereas the third one was simply acknowledging that you can't very well have institutions imposed on people who are not at least able and willing to honor those institutions, that no society works if its institutions are so completely out of sync with the character of the people that the people themselves reject their own institutions. That just, you no longer have a viable society.
Okay, so the difference is then, your number two option, you're saying, the idea is, even if I could unify my culture around specific... Now, when you're talking about religiously pluralistic, you're not talking about... You're not saying that that person, that number three, if I could make the country a Christian nation, if I could get a majority to say that everybody has to go to Presbyterian church on Sunday morning or something like that, I should.
Now say that again.
Well, it seems to me that there's two different kinds of issues when we're talking about pluralism. That a government, it seems to me, has issues that are appropriate for it to address and issues that are not appropriate for it to address. That the government should promote justice, for instance. And our concept of justice can be informed by our religious values, what we believe to be true. And so in option number three, I should be striving, if I can, to convince the people of my society that the model of justice that my government operates on is based in touch with reality and the values of the God who created us and so on.
Right.
Okay. But then there are those issues, it seems to me, where the government, it is not the business of the government to come along, just like it's not the business of the leadership of this church to say specifically to people, you know, you ought to marry this person or you ought to have your quiet time at this time every day or something like that. That it's not the business of the government to come along and dictate to individuals certain kinds of choices they're going to make.
Right.
And it seems to me included in that is ultimately their religious belief choices. That is, for the government to come along and say, we are taking Christianity and making it so there is no room in our society for anyone who has chosen not to believe in Christianity. You cannot shop at Safeway if you don't have your card punched that says you went to church every Sunday or something like
that. Right.
That's a kind of pluralism that is leaving room for the freedom for people to genuinely choose what they're going to believe and live their lives in the light of that, as long as they're not violating those areas where the government has the right to say you should not be unjust, you should not oppress,
right.
You should not. Does that distinction,
right.
Does that make sense?
And yes, you're right. In option number three, I'm not part of what underlies that sentiment in number three is we always have the freedom to not believe at all. We must always have the option to not believe. Otherwise, belief itself is inauthentic. A coerced belief is not a belief. It has to be a freely given belief in order for it to be authentic. And to be in touch with objective reality, we need to give God our freely given belief. So a society based on coerced belief is a false society.
Okay, so we've eliminated all of that. So what then in the distinction between two and three, neither one of them is saying, when you're saying the first one values pluralism and the second one will sort of accept it if it can't accomplish anything better, the kind of pluralism you're talking about is not the freedom to have a plurality of beliefs about...
No. Well, the difference is The second one has bought the diversity is cool value.
Okay.
That is that there that if you could, the second one would have trouble with going out and evangelizing Jews and Muslims and so on, because you don't want to be doing away with the diversity, because diversity is good. The pluralistic religious society is a good society. What we need to strive for is to have the right mixture of Muslims and Jews and Christians and so on, so that we can bona fidely call ourselves pluralistic. The third one recognizes that it is realistic in recognizing that there will be other beliefs, and we are going to have to do business with people of other beliefs and non-believers who don't believe. That's just realistic to know that that's going to be the way the world is. But if I could persuade them to bow the knee to Jesus, and every single one of us bowed the knee to Jesus, would that be an okay society? Absolutely. That would be the best society. The third one acknowledges that. The second one has so internalized the idea that a religious belief is not really about what's objectively real. It's about whatever floats your boat, you know, whatever makes life meaningful to you. That's what a religious belief is. And therefore, we want a variety of different options for people so that they can find meaning in their life in whatever way works for them or whatever.
I just want to say that diversity is cool. And that sounds a little funny, but I think we Christians are accused, and unfortunately all too often fairly accused, of throwing out the baby with the bathwater, maybe, is one way of putting it. And I don't think you were implying this. In fact, something that you said when you were talking about the Christian Palestinian losing his house kind of implied this, but maybe it would be good to reemphasize it or clarify it. Or maybe you don't believe this, but I think it's important for us as believers, especially in light of the global, atrocities, I guess, that are being committed in the name of fundamentalism and in the name of religion. It's important for us as Christians to respect people that believe other things, not to accept the notion that they're right. I think that's a very good point. But to treat them with respect and treat them lovingly and to accept them in that sense, not as right, but with respect. I think that's a Christian value and lovingly. And certainly to evangelize if that seems appropriate, but not to think of them as an infidel that needs to be killed, for example, which is one way that certain fundamentalists treat other people that don't believe what they believe.
Christian?
No, I haven't heard that from the Christian camp yet.
Okay.
Yet. But I just think we need to, at the same time that we affirm the truths that you are teaching, which I think are good and valuable, I think it's important for Christians to distance ourselves from bigotry, let's say. That might be one way of putting it.
The only problem I see in what you're saying, Bob, is that everything you've said is perfectly true and perfectly valid. The problem is, how does that get heard in our culture? When you say respect them, for most people in our culture, to say that they're wrong is inherently disrespectful.
No, that's true. And I think we need to make that distinction whenever we have the opportunity. I was in a diversity meeting last week, and we watched a film about some really horrendous things that our society has done to certain groups. And following the film, one of the first comments from someone that I did not know was, well, yeah, but those fundamentalists are basically doing the same thing as the perversion, as the atrocities of slavery and Chinese slave labor and, you know, on and on and on, all the atrocities that this society has been guilty of. He was lumping fundamentalists in with those types of actions. And I almost said, hey, I'm a fundamentalist. And that I would have had to do a lot of clarifying after that.
and running.
Well, no, I mean, this is a diversity meeting. Come on.
Oh, okay.
They have to accept me, at least to a certain point. But I didn't say that, and maybe that was good, maybe that wasn't. But I guess my point is that, yeah, we do need to be careful what we mean by respecting others. And you're right, I think our society has kind of redefined that term, just like the term diversity, you know. But I just want to encourage us to respect, in the proper sense, people who have other beliefs. That was one thing. And then quickly, and I don't think you meant this either, but when you were talking about, you know, if you're unmarried, if you are childless, and so on, I don't think you were implying a kind of passivity toward learning more about ourselves as sinful human beings and how that contributes to our unhappiness, for example. I think a lot of times, you know, we're sleeping in the bed we've made, and there's a lot of room for us to seek wise counsel and to think about the issues that have led to where we are in life and how we treat people, and just really be willing to examine that and see if there are things that I can do to change, to grow, to learn about myself that will make my situation, make the way I treat other people better than it is.
Okay, good. I had a couple of questions. First and foremost, I was just going to ask about, like, the evolutionary nature of the Bible. You talked about the promise, like the deed that God gave to the Jews or whatever. I was just curious if that was in any way changed or invalidated in any form by the fact that they rejected the Messiah that he had given to them. It seems like that might have some sort of, that he might reprimand them somehow, or it might that promise might become less significant. I don't know if that's the proper way of looking at the Bible. It seems like it'd be null and void after that, but I don't.
Yeah, well, that's what I say. I was assuming a particular interpretation. There are many, many people whom I respect greatly who would not agree with me and would say that that has been basically made null and void by their rejection of God. I don't think so. I mean, that's not my way of reading it. But yeah, if one were to interpret it the other way, then obviously one couldn't bring that fact into public discourse because it's no longer a fact. I mean, that would be a false belief. But I don't. My assumption was that that's not.
Okay. And the only other thing that I was going to ask is, like, it seems like in the past that when politics and like religious beliefs, like when they tend to mix or become too close of friends, that one or the other, usually religion gets perverted in some way. I mean, a really cliche example would be like the Inquisition, and I was just curious how. Is there any way to try and avoid the perversion of religion? Because it seems like, you know, people should be able to assert their religious beliefs in the political and public sphere, but it seems like that might, becoming too close to that, it might,
yeah,
have a perverting effect. Yeah, it might entangle them.
I think Christians cannot help but always be in the position of revolutionaries and reformers. Our institutions will never embody the values of Christian belief. They will always be at some level or another at a perversion of them, I think. And so the only position that we can ever really validly take is to have a prophetic voice into them, to call them back to what they claim they actually believe. Yes, anytime religion and politics get entangled, religion becomes perverse. Anytime religion and politics are not entangled, religion becomes perverse. Religion just becomes perverse.
Tightrope walk.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
All right. I was feeling Bob. Bob's got it going on. Bob Blanchard over there.
You're stealing him?
I was feeling him. He got it right. But here's what I'm saying. The bad rap fundamentalist get. Okay. There was at some point in our wonderful Christian culture where AIDS popped up on the scene and everybody was rejoicing because it was God taking his vengeance out on the evil homosexuals. I find that appalling. Like, that's just the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And I know good Christians who I love dearly who propagated such silliness. I was wondering if we don't perceive homosexuals as a special evil because of our Protestant total mortification of sex in general. Like I mean, and here's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think a homosexual becomes a homosexual because he says, how is the best way to rebel against God? And therefore he chooses homosexuality because that really ticks God off. Like, it strikes me that homosexuals become homosexuals because of the curriculum that God gave them, and I don't want to go too divine determinants, but what I'm saying is like I come from the ghetto, I speak certain ways, I do certain things, I can like rap music. Like, the homosexuals I've known, they're homosexuals because this is a generalization, but for some reason I find it to be true. Many people are like abused and had an unfortunate relationship with their parents, and in them trying to make sense of existence, they have left the option of homosexuality open, whereas I have not, because I was raised with a more traditional Christian background, and I just don't swing that way. When a homosexual is not, in my opinion, when he chooses to be homosexual, rebelling against God, like that, when he says, I'm gay, I'm here, I'm queer, whatever the hell, like, but it strikes me any more than when a Jew says, I'm going to be a Jew, like, I don't believe in the Messiah, I'm going to be Jew, I'm going to believe that or Catholic, I'm going to believe that my works can save you. But isn't it like our true rebellions come out when we come face to face with truth and a coherent worldview that is challenging ours? Like, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't, it's always perceived that someone says, you know, I'm gay, and therefore, like, that's their big step away from God, and that doesn't make sense to me. I don't see myself in a different boat than the homosexual personally. Like the moments of rebellion against God have nothing to do with what identity I choose for myself, but rather when my identity is challenged by truth with a capital T, reality with capital R. Like, and that's true forever. I mean, that's on the practical realm. I mean, when I rub shoulders with the great unwashed, they're just normal people. And some of them, when I say I have an opinion this way, they're down with it, and some don't agree, but I can tell that they're not going to stone me for it, and their story isn't done as much as my story isn't done. And so, I mean, when we draw lines, I mean, I say there's a truth, and I believe that, and my dialogues with homosexuality is always, I like bringing to the nature of what, are you born that way, or are you made that way, and I don't go into the divine determinism I have adopted from you, because then it even further confuses it, because then in the end, when they say that God made them that way, I go, yeah, and he made Hitler an asshole, and he made all sorts of other things. But that's not productive. So when we say, I mean, when we use homosexual in broad terms, aren't we missing the point already? I mean, their culture is bad, but if you look at the psychological development of people in general, well, fuck, we shouldn't like anybody. I mean, like...
Okay, well, let me ask you...
I said a lot. I always say so much.
Let me ask you a question.
Okay,
let me ask you a question. What about liars? Do they make a choice and they say, I'm going to lie here because I don't like God and I want to rebel against God and he's kind of all about truth, but I'm going to tell a lie instead because I want to get back at God. I want to rebel against God. Probably not.
Oh, so you were going to answer the question, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
You take too long. Sorry. I mean, do you not agree?
No, I don't have a problem with that, but I'm okay. Feeling like you're going to trick me. You Socrates!
It seems to me. So, I mean, what you're saying is true. It's not self-consciously rebelling against God, but I don't think our actions need to be self-consciously rebelling against God in order for them to be rebelling against God. I mean, I think much of what we do is rebelling against God. Very relatively little of it do I experience as a self-conscious rebellion against God.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
Well, okay, but where you just stepped there was the moral theory, the theological kind of like exegetion or whatever the proper correction, you can figure it out later. That's like a theoretical realm almost. But when you're sitting down with people, it's not that. It's not just that it's not that simple. It's simple in the way that I said it. Like,
right.
They're not.
Well, where you see the rebellion is when you sit down with people and you open up the Bible and you come across a Bible passage talking about how unnatural and perverse the very practice that they're engaged in is. Do they go, oh, really? Well, if that's the case, then I better stop it.
Okay, but you just simplified it. Now, because if some schmuck from like religion, like wacko internet religion number 5 came up and said, you know, my religion doesn't agree with the fact that you use the F word in church. Like now, am I just going to take that guy's? I mean, isn't there a complex like foundation of knowledge that a person has to come to before they're going to even and rightly give the Bible
sure.
authority? If I can't, I mean,
sure.
if I made something
sure.
up and said, you know, you're wrong.
Like, yeah, I mean, so your point is that to evaluate a person's destiny based on the snapshot of their life right now is totally short-sighted because they may be in process.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, I'm objecting to the simplification of the issue. Like, it strikes me that I've sat across from people and they haven't agreed with me and they've had every right, given their experience and worldview, at that point to disagree with me. Now, it just strikes me that when you get to God and someone's like, God says to a homosexual, you know what, I ain't down with that here. You either got to take it somewhere else or fix some shit. Like, the truly rebellious will just be like, go to hell, God. Like,
right.
Which would be ironic and weird. But,
right.
Anyway. But I mean, so on earth, when we say, I mean, it's just, not even just a snapshot. It's just that people, when you say the Bible has authority, I mean, there's so many complex issues in this dialogue about what the nature of government is, but really even, how do people formulate their beliefs about what knowledge and what do they believe? And if you're not raised in a Christian home, why are you expected when I throw a verse at you and say that queers are bad, why would that person be expected to say, oh, you know what? I've been living a lie and just throw it all off. I mean, this human God is worth, and that's why I promote the Jesus rubbing shoulders with the great unwashed, because that's how you're going to have any sort of dialogue with anybody. I mean,
okay.
The Palestinians
that's
in this house trash, like, I don't, at that day, I don't give a fuck what the hell he believes. Like, I don't need to say, you know, God's all about the promise and you just got screwed, but you shouldn't have built your house there. Like that's going to come out through my entire relationship with that individual over the course of our entire lives on this earth.
Okay, how is that different than what
I was saying? Well, no, I'm not. I'm just trying to, it was the simple, I mean, and you can't possibly, I mean, you've had long questions this whole time, so you can't possibly hash through how complex I think this issue is and how complex I think I know you think it is.
Right.
But that was my question.
Yeah, I mean, your point is well taken that we are all complex people. We are very complex people. The beliefs that we form are very complex, and we need to respect that those people are having to do business with their creator in their way, in the context of their story and their narrative of their lives and so on. And for me to just sort of short-sightedly dismiss all that is evil of me. It is perverse of me. Let me make one last point. And with respect to sexuality, the other thing to remember is most of our sexuality is perverse. All of us. We are just perverse sinners. And homosexuality is just one example, one manifestation of the ways in which we pervert sexuality. But heterosexuals have all kinds of perverse attitudes and perspectives and takes on their sexuality as well. We all need to clean it up. We all need to pursue purity in our lives. So the problem that you're looking at is just a cultural problem where we as heterosexual believers may look at homosexuals and as a class, you know, kind of consign them to hell without looking at our own lives. And the fact of the matter is we are all touched by impurity. We take what God has given and we pervert it. We just do. And that's why we need the mercy of God. Kept you over, I need to let you go, but